after the police officer murdered George Floyd, people in communities across America have really tried to get away from proactive policing by recognizing that the outcomes are not particularly great for certain demographics. There, the argument from Henning, again, the professor, is that that may be some kind of trade-off, because according to him, there is evidence that proactive policing can help stop crime before it happens. The other version of this is this reactive policing, which is essentially just responding to calls, whether that's somebody coming up to a police officer on the street and saying, hey, I saw somebody over here, this is what's happening, or something, like dispatch calls. Oregon, Portland, and sort of nationally has kind of turned toward reactive policing instead. And so it kind of fits the police narrative to say that the crime is way up because A, people don't like us, B, we don't have the budgets, and so we're not able to go out and stop crime before it happens, and that's why you see this big crime wave. Again, our reporting doesn't demonstrate any sort of significant crime wave at all. And also, the idea of the police budgets, is another piece of that. There may be an interest from police departments to get money to continue doing their practices. The police budget now, again, I don't know how many times you can say this, the Portland Police Bureau was never defunded. It's been up from about $208 million in 2016 to $295 million this year. And then policing, the actual police officer rates appears to have very little to do with their budget. So their own kind of, whether if they have staffing issues, another thing that kind of comes up frequently, maybe sort of an internal HR thing for them to deal with, but it is not based on the fact that they don't have enough money. There was a brief dip, just to be clear, right around in 2020, and that was consistent with across the board 4.8% basically budget cuts.
So just to I guess belabor the point, the police having more money doesn't relate to this being a crime ripple, as you say.
There's really no evidence here that the funding or this supposed defunding, to say defunded is false, does not appear to really correlate with any data points that we found through looking at, at the much deeper kind of raw data here. And there's certainly nothing to show that there's a causal relationship there either.
Yeah, well, and I think the other piece of that, I think, that gets brought up with funding, like Jeremiah said, is staffing, right? We've heard a lot about how PPB is understaffed. Currently, they have 7% fewer police officers than they did in 2016. That shortage has been as much as 20% below previous staffing levels since 2020, according to PPB, depending on the month and year that the figure was collected in. Even still, there isn't really, there's no correlation in the data between, the current staffing levels and the amount of alleged crimes happening, the amount of arrests, the amount of calls. And, from talking with experts, particularly Roussel and Thompson, it was clearly a theme that there is no really solid body of evidence indicating that more police means less crime. There's not a very direct relationship there between police staffing and the amount of crime. And like Jeremiah said, it's because police don't really prevent crime. Fundamentally, they respond to crime, which, according to Thompson, if the goal is for police to prevent crime, then then the goal is a police state, right? Because in order to have enough police to prevent crime, you have to have this kind of, omnipotent police force that is everywhere you look, monitoring people's daily lives. And I think it's become a much more kind of accepted turn in criminology and sociology to instead look towards the actual causes of crime, which are not enough police, but rather, this kind of complex mixture of economics, social status, government problems, like systemic issues generally, and this kind of confluence. And of course, like, social and familial things are wrapped up in that. It's a very complex thing, but nowhere in there is not enough police, right? So that, and the data certainly indicates that as well, that, to the extent that there was an increase in crime in Portland, which, again, not a whole lot of evidence to support that, plenty of evidence, I think, going in the other direction, staffing at PCB was not the cause of increased crime.
If you're just tuning in, this is KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Street Roots Editor-in-Chief Kay Rambo and Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden about a trio of stories they published this week called The Great Portland Crime Ripple. Let's get back to it. Can you talk a little bit about what isn't in this crime rate? Roussel, one of the professors you spoke to, underscored the significance of state violence sort of being outside of what we think of as crime and crime statistics.
Right. This is a really interesting point because if you look into this data, there are no, it just does not include things that police do that actually cause harm in the community. And that's something that Roussel talked about a lot, is for judging certain things that are sort of these social constructs of what crime is by definition, that can be one thing. But if you start looking at harms created in a society and then included the harms that police can cause for communities, you know, those are very different numbers. And so we don't include in this data, there's no police shootings included in here. It doesn't talk about if a homeless resident in Portland is swept and their medications or their personal belongings are taken by the police, you know, that doesn't fall under the larceny charges here in this data. And so that's kind of another example of the way that the police are able to control this narrative, kind of, you know, going in and going out. And it is, you know, one, if those things were to be included, these numbers would probably look quite different. But there may be a reason that they're not included in there.
Well, the final part of this triumvirate of articles is called If It Bleeds, It Leads. Kay, you wrote this one solo. What part does the media have to play in this perception of a crime wave that defies the data, as you guys have talked about?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, kind of, we certainly didn't set out, I think, to write anything about the media writ large. I think, you know, kind of what happened was the more we spoke with people and the more we asked about, you know, I mean, and really doing our due diligence, making sure that our data, you know, was accurate and lined up with what professional researchers were doing and seeing themselves, we kind of kept arriving at the same question of, well, how do you have, you know, no data really to support this idea that there's this huge increase in crime. But I think, you know, you can look at any public opinion poll in the last several years in Portland asking people what they're most concerned about. Crime and public safety, along with homelessness, are, you know, that's often the one and two. Maybe housing is in there, right? But crime is something that people are really concerned about in Portland. And so through that process, I mean, we just heard more and more about how much of a role the media can play in that. And Melissa Thompson, one of the criminologists we interviewed, is also an expert in the media, you know, the representation of crime in media, and actually teaches a class about it. And, you know, Roussel spoke about it at length too. But basically, you know, the idea is that the more serious a crime is, the more violent it is, the more likely it is to be the lead story. And that's, you know, there's some validity to that, right? I mean, people are most concerned about those types of crimes, so it makes sense that media outlets would often lead with them. At the same time, when that is presented without full context, it begins to convince people that crime is much more prevalent than it actually is. And that's something that Thompson talked about over the last, you know, couple of decades, a few decades really. Crime has been decreasing a lot in Portland, very substantially, throughout the country as well. But in that same time period, there's this inverse relationship where crime is going down steadily, and yet media coverage of crime is going up steadily at the same time. So you end up with this kind of strange contradiction that ultimately, I think, leads to public perception being something that doesn't line up with the data, because, you know, that broader context is typically not being included with those reports.
If I can add to that too, there's a piece of this where if the police are kind of controlling the data and then controlling the narrative and the media, often one of the things that Thompson talked about is the media, you know, for various reasons, not having time, short deadlines, you know, a person who's been under arrest is very difficult to get a hold of to hear their kind of story. But like police and crime reporting is kind of this one place in media world where you can simply write police say and then copy what they say in the press release and call it good journalism. And that's kind of a special thing here. And that kind of raises eyebrows anytime, you know, you might read a article that says police say this. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's the straight story, you know, and doesn't have multiple perspectives in that. The second thing is that, you know, Portland Police Chief Bob Day, when he was instated as a chief a few months ago, talked about his role, seeing his role as being reducing crime and the fear of crime. And so it kind of raises this question as police control the narrative, often through the media, through sending, you know, press releases out and through contacts with the media to say, here's what's going on with crime in the city. It kind of raises an interesting question about how the chief feels that he could actually reduce fear of crime, and that he sees that as something that is his responsibility within that job description.
Speaking specifically of Bob Day, and I think media coverage, you know, one of the things that we looked at in part one that I think is, you know, relevant in, to part three is you know, January press conference, the same one that Jeremiah is describing, where, you know, Bob Day brought up a reported 88% increase in shoplifting last year, right? Now, when you look at the data, larcenies last year were at an 8-year low. So over the last 8 years, the number of reported thefts was lower than it was in any other year. Arrests for shoplifting are down over the last 4 years by almost 67% compared to the 4 years, the 4 years preceding the pandemic. So, you know, I mean, the data that we had didn't really indicate that there was that 88% increase in reported shoplifting. And this is all, I think, you know, importantly, kind of on this backdrop of PPB becoming very publicly vocal about retail theft, you know, dedicating specific retail theft missions where they're partnering with private businesses to do loss prevention work. And even with that, you know, the number of shoplifting arrests are way lower than they were before the pandemic. So, and, you know, when we contacted PPB and say, hey, this is your data, this is what it indicates to us, where's your sourcing for this 88% increase? We were told that Chief Day was on vacation and that they couldn't provide us with the source for that 88% increase. You know, which is really just to say, I think that there are, you know, I think how the Bureau comes up with reported crimes is not terribly transparent. We could not get an answer from them for how that number is compiled. But, you know, that is obviously a shocking statistic. So, of course, it was, I mean, there are numerous news outlets in Portland that ran with that headline that kind of made it to the national circuit as well. But then when you step back and look at the data, I mean, there's nothing available to actually support that statement. So yeah, I mean, you know, which I think is just kind of part of this broader issue with, you know, really one-sided sourcing. And I think, you know, time constraints, staffing restraints in newsrooms, it's not terribly feasible that everything the police say is going to go through the type of fact-checking that we were able to dedicate to all of this, you know, through three articles.
Well, on this point of perception, I want to know, how does everyone that you talked to and everything that you reported on, how does this relate to the homelessness crisis on Portland streets?
This is a really interesting point because a lot of people see, and it's been really sad actually to kind of see the conflation of people who don't have a place to stay inside and crime. It's pretty commonly known that homeless residents are far more likely to be victims of crime than they are to commit crimes. But we see this through, you know, all the same kinds of narratives from elected leaders, the police, and, you know, from other media outlets, and it makes its way into the community so that when people see things like tents and tarps, they immediately associate that. There's this sort of heuristic response as if there's a crime happening. And then when you couple that sort of with, you know, Supreme Court decision saying that it's okay to criminalize homelessness, then homelessness itself kind of does become a crime regardless of, you know, what sort of, like who's being harmed there. And it's unfortunate to kind of see that start to be or continue to be conflated in that way.
you know, and on that note, I mean, that was like a specific thing Roussel brought up in effort to explain why there is such a huge gap between public perception and what the data actually shows. But you do have that association of homelessness with criminality. So a lot of people will, the more they see tents and tarps, like Jeremiah said, the more they assume that there's crime happening. So when someone tells them there's a crime wave or there's this increase in the crime rate, even if there isn't, they're going to be more likely to believe that. And at least Roussel felt that that, you know, could be a not insignificant part of why this narrative, despite it having very little evidence, has been able to gain such a foothold in court.
What are the takeaways that you hope folks get from these stories?
I mean, there's a few. I mean, with it being three stories, I think the big thing to me, just after doing all of this work and going through all this data and talking with experts in the city, and I think there's no real evidence to suggest that Portland is in the grips of a crime wave, nor has there been evidence to support that in the previous 4 years. You know, arrests are down 44% in the last 4 years. Dispatch calls from the public resulting in police being dispatched have gone down in the last 4 years. And I think also, you know, one thing we do talk about, like Jeremiah pointed out, is cherry picking and how, you know, if you zoom in far enough, you can really find, and you're selective enough, you can find data points that support pretty much any conclusion, right? So I think it's also just a helpful reminder that, you know, when you see statistics from the police or from the mayor or from whoever, that, you know, they're comparing 1 month of 1 year to 1 month of another year, or 6 months, or even year to year, you know, based on what we heard from experts, that, you know, there may be more to the story than you're getting, right? And there may be a very specific reason why those two seemingly arbitrary points are being compared. And I do think that that's something that's worth remembering from this article.
Jeremiah, any takeaways for you?
Well, you know, crime can be sort of a Rorschach test for people, you know, and one of the things that I think is really gratifying in this article is that Kay and I just kind of entered into that looking at, you know, some open PPB data and kind of seeing like, hey, okay, so where are these crimes happening? We keep hearing about it just like everyone else. We live in Portland and, you know, just kind of continued looking at this stuff. And the more we, this was meant to be one story, you know, maybe even a month or two, published a month or two ago. And the more we looked, the more we found, you know, just less evidence that kind of that narrative that we see every day is what's really kind of happening in the world. So I think it's a really interesting story. I hope people dig into these. There's three of them here. And I think we, speaking with a number of experts and looking at data from kind of all of the different angles, this can be, again, the call volume, this is like the arrests, what types of supposed crimes are being committed, staffing, budgets, kind of hits it from a bunch of different angles. And when it's put under that kind of scrutiny, the narrative really doesn't hold up.
That was Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, and Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, talking with me about a trio of new articles out this week, The Great Portland Crime Ripple. You are listening to KBOO News and Review. I'm your news director, Althea Billings. From now until the new year, we'll be taking a look back at some of our favorite and most impactful stories from 2024. Don't forget, you can support our end-of-year membership drive anytime during this show. Go online to kboo.fm/give to make a donation. Thank you. This next Street Roots story is a more recent one. It's from earlier in December. You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, to talk about their latest story. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here with us. Your story this week, it's called Referring to Be Referred. Critics' lawsuits say ODOC healthcare panels delay and deny care. ODOC won't say who actually serves on committees or how many requests and referrals they deny. So this is actually part two of your investigation into the Oregon Department of Corrections, which has overseen over the past few years the deadliest period in the modern history of Oregon's prison. So a lot to discuss here. Could you give us a quick rundown of what you discovered in that first part of your investigation?
Absolutely. It really started, you know, we tend to track annual deaths in prisons. And, you know, we just kind of realized that the percentage, you know, the death rates are going up. The number of people dying is going up. And at the same time, the population is decreasing. So part one was really talking with experts and looking at reports and kind of figuring out, like, where could things be, you know, where could the cause be for this increase in deaths? And, you know, everyone I spoke to believed that there was, you know, a combination of factors at play. One of them is that Oregon's prison population, like every prison population, is aging. You know, the average age of prisoners is going up. And then the big things beyond that were really healthcare. And so I kind of used that as a jumping off point to really start looking into what healthcare is like in prisons. And that led me to these healthcare panels that this story really focuses on.
Well, right. In this piece, you discuss therapeutic levels of care committees, or TLCs, which are these panels in the correction system that decide if and when people can get certain medical treatments, and it kind of runs the gamut. What were you able to find out about how these so-called TLCs, how do they work?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, unfortunately, I think ODOC, Oregon Department of Corrections, did not provide answers to questions by the time we published the story. Hopefully that changes, but, you know, we didn't get a ton of explanation for how these committees work or really what the decision-making process is. What we do know, based on what we were able to get via public records requests, was that essentially these are panels of doctors, nurses, pharmacists, healthcare personnel in ODOC, and they are presented with these requests that are, or referrals from prisoners or ODOC healthcare professionals that say, you know, this person either needs this treatment, I believe, or they requested this particular treatment, or, you know, things like eyeglasses, hearing aids, are also go to a TLC, at which point the committee will then deliberate and decide whether or not that person can receive that treatment or that medical device. The state's administrative rules do include some considerations that TLCs may use in their decision making, but even the way that is written, it's presented much more as a suggestion rather than an actual rule that they have to follow.
So there are these sort of opaque panels that make these sort of decisions about people's medical care. And there's multiple case studies that you talk about in the article from incarcerated people who have sued the Department of Corrections over delays and denials that they've gotten at the hands of these TLCs. Can you talk through what those timelines look like? What have they experienced?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the first part of that question, I mean, there are a lot of lawsuits against the Oregon Department of Corrections for its healthcare practices, which isn't, you know, unique to ODOC, right? But a lot of those lawsuits center on these committees and the allegation that they delay or deny care improperly, and that by doing so, the prisons are showing deliberate indifference to people's healthcare needs. I read a lot of lawsuits and really only had the space to include information about a few of them because I think the system itself is so kind of layered and complex. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about who may be making those decisions. But, you know, I mean, there were cases where somebody was told they needed surgery and it took 2 years for them to get that surgery. There was another case where somebody complained about having hip pain and it was several years later that they were able to get a hip replacement. And it was a year later that they even were evaluated for problems with their hips. So, you know, it is, at least according to court records. So there is certainly some cases where people's care was delayed for a long time, which, you know, in most cases, a judge has found that that's fine, that that's legal. But I think, you know, obviously prisoners are concerned and advocates are concerned that if there is this kind of culture of indifference or delaying, you know, necessary care for people, that it may be contributing to the increase in deaths and contributing to a deterioration of people's health.
I know some of this is, again, opaque. What are some of the justifications that a TLC might have for denying someone that kind of care?
Well, I mean, it is really hard to know. And oftentimes, you know, those specific deliberations are not really included in what I was able to find in court records. Oftentimes, all that's really there are kind of the conclusions, you know, and I saw things like, you know, not at this time, continue evaluation and monitor, postpone as long as possible, right? And that's in the case of the person who needed a hip replacement. You know, there's just, it is very unclear, I think, why some of these things are denied. But, you know, there is this list of considerations, and it's things like, could a treatment be delayed without causing a significant progression? Any relevant functional disability and the degree of functional improvement? Any known costs or benefits relative to those costs, things like whether or not somebody was already receiving care for something before they got into prisons, which, you know, that's of course a concern for people who didn't have health care, and that may have been why they weren't receiving that care. So, you know, it is unclear, I think, at this time, why these decisions are made, why these procedures are delayed. And of course, you know, what we heard from critics and advocates was, you know, it's about cost, it's about the logistics of having to set up an appointment. There is a lawsuit right now from a former ODOC nurse manager that's a whistleblower lawsuit, saying essentially that the prisons had no system for ensuring that appointments were even made after a TLC approved something. So, you know, I think in addition to there being certainly a level of opacity around what decisions are being made and why, I think there's also currently a lack of clarity for, you know, potential other problems in this process.
You touched on this a little bit, but as you were investigating this, there was a lot of information that ODOC, Department of Corrections, would not give you for various reasons. What were some of those?
Well, you know, the initial request I sent them was really trying to figure out, A, who's invited. Is there a specific list? Does it change? Because obviously, you know, consistency in decision-making, I think, is important for things like this. And if it's different people making those decisions, that kind of consistency isn't really guaranteed. And then I also wanted attendance records, right? Like, are there some people who show up every week? Are there some people who only show up once a month? And ODOC refused to release those records, stating that it would be a problem for patient privacy, which, you know, this is a bit in the weeds, but, you know, the precedent in Oregon, which is really well established at this point, is that if a document, a public record, contains both confidential and public information, the confidential information should be redacted, and then the document is released, right? So there was, you know, I think a point that I, as a journalist, still don't necessarily agree with there. What they did ultimately provide were Microsoft Teams invites, because these meetings are hybrid. So some people get their invitations via Teams and they attend online. But some people may get those invitations and go in person and vice versa. So there's really, you know, what they provided me didn't give a ton of information just in terms of figuring out who's making these decisions and how much consistency there is in invitations and attendance.
To add on to this, there's an added component of who is on these TLCs, which, like you said, is in some ways unknown. And from the information that you were able to gather, there are people involved in this that may not be sufficiently qualified for consulting, or they've been in trouble with the Oregon Medical Board before.
It's important to note that, you know, going back to the state's administrative rules for these TLC committees, which, you know, those are essentially enshrined by law, the ODOC chief of medicine is the final authority. So the chief of medicine is the person who has the final word on whether or not people's healthcare requests or referrals are approved. That's Dr. Warren Roberts for ODOC, and he is a neurosurgeon by trade. He's been with the department since 2020. but he cannot perform surgery in Oregon due to an agreement with the Oregon Medical Board following board issuing a complaint and notice of proposed disciplinary action that alleged he violated the State Medical Practice Act. And there were a couple times that, you know, I can see in the records that they reached out to him with something like that and he responded. And initially the Oregon Medical Board proposed a $10,000 fine, revocation of his medical license, unless he completed multiple mentorships that assessed his medical knowledge, clinical judgment, and ability to practice safely. In 2020, the same year he was hired by ODOC, he did strike a deal with the Oregon Medical Board that concluded the ongoing investigation they had without findings, and essentially he still can't perform surgery unless he does complete a reentry plan involving a board-approved surgical mentorship. So, you know, he himself at least has this track record, you know, with the Oregon Medical Board of potentially displaying poor judgment based on their records. He also, in 2017, settled a malpractice lawsuit for $1 million. And that was certainly something I heard as I talked to people, that there was real concern that the person with the final word in all of this, as recently as, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, was facing concerns from the Oregon Medical Board that somebody needed to evaluate his medical knowledge and clinical judgment, when it would appear that a large part of his job is medical knowledge and clinical judgment, regardless of whether or not he's actually practicing medicine in ODOC. He again has the final say on what decisions are made by the TLC.
That was Kay Rambo, the editor-in-chief of Street Roots, speaking with me about their latest story. It's called Referring to Be Referred. Critics' lawsuits say ODOC healthcare panels delay and deny care. ODOC won't